So we're taking up in October the 30th, 1923, and this is volume 16. I want you to notice something in the heading. The soul who lives in the divine will is nourished by the flames of Jesus. No problem there. The problem is in the next line. She must be filtered through the most pure light of the divine will. Filtered. Okay. And must be exposed to the rays of its burning and eternal sun so as to be deified. So there's no way we can be deified without the most horrendous purification. That's just giving it to you in simple English. So if you're walking on cushions, get worried. Louisa said, I live always embittered and with my heart petrified by the pain of the privation of my sweet Jesus. I feel I am without life because the one who is true life is not with me. That means visibly he is there all the time. If he's not there, then the kingdom of God is not within her, is it? Oh, how often I repeat, tell me, oh, my only and highest good, where did you direct your steps so that by following them I may find you? Now, that's straight out of the Song of Songs, and it's probably chapter 3. I've given it to you many times, so I haven't written it down again. Where the bride tells all her friends, you know, tell me where he is and I will find him, you know. And it's like Mary of Magdala on Easter Day as well. So that's John 20. So she'd be prepared even to ask the soldiers at the grave, if they were there, where Jesus was. From afar, I kiss those hands of yours, which with so much love used to embrace me and press me to your heart. I adore and kiss that face, which so much grace and beauty would let itself be seen by me, and now it hides and is far away from me. Tell me, where are you? That's Song of Songs 5:8. Which way should I take so as to come and reach you? Tell me what I should do. Now, here is the soul unbearably unable to tolerate not having him in the way she had before. So that is also Psalm 63. My soul agonizes, okay, for you. Even my body pines for you like a dry, weary land without water, Psalm 63. Yet you told me that you would never leave me, and now you leave me. Jesus, Jesus, come back to the one who cannot live without you, to your little daughter, to the poor exiled one. So what you have there is someone in a very high state of love and not being able to tolerate the beloved not being present. And as you've read many times in these writings, Jesus himself says love cannot tolerate separation. It just cannot do it. But who can say all my laments and the nonsense that I spoke? In the meantime, I felt I was losing consciousness. Ah, who's present then? And I saw a dove. I want to give you that Song of Songs 4:1. The bridegroom calls the bride a dove. And the dove is all on fire. So that is divine love, which was agonizing. What does she do? She sees herself. She sees herself symbolically. And it was agonizing. And someone was near. In other words, he doesn't leave her. Who with his burning breath was feeding the dove with his flames in order to nourish it, preventing it from taking any other food, holding it tightly and so close to his mouth that it could do nothing other than breathe and swallow the flames which came from him. And the poor dove agonized and turned into those flames. That means turned into divine love. This is the thing I was pointing out to you in the heading, that we have to be filtered through the most pure light of the divine will. So the little dove is turned into those flames with which it was nourished. Louisa said, I was surprised on seeing this and my sweet Jesus moving in my interior. There's your Luke 17:21, the kingdom of God is within you. So moving in my interior told me, my daughter, why do you fear that I might leave you? In order to leave you, I would have to leave myself. Why? Because this is volume 16 and he has told us many times that he and Louisa are one. Okay. Which I cannot do. As much power as I have, I do not have the power to detach from myself. The same for one who does my will, since he becomes inseparable from me. Now, that inseparable thing is the union. And it's complete union, okay? And you can put John 14, 20 to 21, you in me and I in you. You can put Galatians 2, 20. I no longer live, but Christ lives in me. Okay. So he becomes inseparable from me. I lack the power to detach from him. Now, throughout all of these writings, Jesus refers to his mother as my inseparable mother. Now, notice we're in volume 16. He's now referring to Louisa as inseparable. So she has arrived at this extraordinary state. And he's trying to explain to her why she's suffering, because she is flung into the divine flames of love. So since he becomes inseparable from me, I lack the power to detach from him. And not only this, but I keep nourishing him with my own flames. Now, that love is so superior to the love they would have at a lower stage in the ordinary spiritual life. And that is so superior from what people have living a purely natural life, that somebody living a natural life would have no way of appreciating the love that Jesus is talking about here. They'd have no way at all. Quite literally, they would say you are living on a different planet. Have you not seen that dove all afire? It was the image of your soul. And the one who was feeding it with his burning breath was, we would say, was me. And I delight so much in nourishing one who lives in my will with only the flames unleashed by my heart through my breath. So those are the flames of divine love. Don't you know that one who lives in my will must be filtered? Oh, I hate that word. It feels terrible. Because if you're going to be filtered, it means intellect, memory, will, desires, motivations, feelings, everything, the senses, everything has got to be filtered. Now, St. John of the Cross tells us that he filters the senses first. That's in the first purification. And in the second terrible purification, it's the purification of the intellect, memory and will. And it's so terrible that many people don't allow it to actually continue. They're afraid. It must be filtered with its most pure light. Now, light can get through anything. You know, you pull your curtains at night and you think you've got complete darkness. You come down in the morning and the light has managed to get through the curtains. It can filter through the most extraordinary things. And to be filtered is more than to be put under a press. That's why I'm emphasizing it. Now, the press, you see, is a biblical word. So it's either the wine press, you know, or the press for pressing the grapes to make the wine. And that's a ferocious experience for the grapes, you know. And he says to be filtered is much worse than to be put under a press. Because even though the press smashes everything to pieces, it lets everything out, skin and seeds, which settle down at the bottom and leave always something cloudy. On the other hand, when something is filtered, especially then if it is filtered through the thick light of my will, oh, I don't like the word thick. You're not going to get through that one, are you? If it's filtered through the thick light of my will, there's no danger that it might deposit something cloudy. Rather, everything is clear, similar to the clearness of the light which has been filtered. And this is a great honour for the soul who lives in my will, that whether she thinks, speaks, loves, etc., my will takes on the commitment to filter whatever she does through with the most pure light. And this is necessary so that in everything she does, there may be no distinction from what we do. So remember all the scriptures I've given to you for the last 16 volumes. And that is Hebrews 12:14. Nothing unholy or unworthy can enter the presence of God. Do you remember?
Yeah.
Hebrews 12:14. You've got Isaiah 35. Now, at this moment, I can't remember the verse, but the whole thing is about the redeemed of the Lord, and nothing unclean can walk this path. It's as simple as that. You also have Revelation 21. It's at the very end, and Revelation 22, speaking about the New Jerusalem. And both of them say that for people not committed to the will of God, I'm simply using our language, okay, they have to stay outside. They can't be in the city. It's as simple as that. So for those of us who want to be in the city, he's saying that this terrifying filtering has to go on. And so as you go on, you will begin to realize that the Lord will get you to notice that I shouldn't be thinking exactly that way. It should be slightly different. I shouldn't be wanting that particular way. I should be wanting something slightly different. Do you know what I mean? So you get this adjustment all the time. And the more generous you are in responding to it, the heavier he comes on until he gets the job done. But it can be harrowing, particularly if it's something that you thought was yours and you had every right to have it. You know what I mean? And it's part of you anyway. Do you know what I mean? And it's part of your inheritance and it's in your DNA. And we use all these excuses. And he says, no, 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 no. I can get through with your DNA. And this horrendous thing. Let me just illustrate this in a story I might have told you before. Many years ago, I had to give a retreat in a community. Won't say where, because this is going on record. When I walked in to give the first talk, I had to approach the room from the back. And so I had to walk up through the community and then turn around and face them. The very first person I met was somebody like this, sitting on a seat all by herself behind them all. And she looked up at me and caught my eye, and I caught her eye. And written all over her face was, "Forget about it, no hope." Another one gone. So I knew I was written off. It didn't take her 10 seconds to write me off. And so I went up and gave my talk and went back to, they actually gave me an apartment that they usually give to priests, and went back to my apartment and I said, "Lord, I'm not going to put the lights on. I'm not going to bed. I'm not going to do anything. You are going to tell me what's wrong with her, because she has written me off and she has some desperate need that somebody has to answer." And I said, since she knows I'm useless, I might as well admit it. And I said, "Please tell me for her sake." So I stayed there and he told me exactly what it was. So the following morning, when I went in to give my first talk, I had to pass her by again. And this time she was just sitting there, you know, "I have to sit here. I'm under obedience," kind of stuff, you know. And I bent down to her and I said, "I want to see you after the talk. It's urgent." She looked at me in amazement. And then I continued on. I said, "Well, the shoe's on the other foot now." She got me thinking. Now I've got her thinking. So after the talk, I took her by the hand and I said, "You and I are coming for a cup of coffee." And because in this apartment, I could make tea and coffee for my guests. And I sat her down and I said to her, "You are wondering why you're here." She said, "Absolutely." I said, "It's because you wrote me off last night." She said, "Was it that obvious?" I said, "Yeah, I got it." I said, "I got the message clear as daylight." And she looked a bit embarrassed and I said, "Don't be embarrassed." I said, "You made me pray for you half the night until I got the answer." She said, "Did you get the answer?" And I said, "Yeah." Oh, she said, "Don't give me the coffee then, just give me the answer." And here was a soul that was absolutely desperate. She told me she was dying of cancer. She had a short time to live. She was in a desperate crisis. She had gone to every priest she knew, got no response that she could think of that could help. She said, "Nobody's able to help me." And I said, "Okay, stop. I can tell you the next sentence. You think there's something radically wrong with you, that you won't be saved and you're going to meet your God soon. And that's your problem. And she said, yeah. I said, the problem you have, darling, is that you're in the second night. And the Lord is doing such an absolutely unbelievable purification on your intellect, memory and will and everything. I said, that you think there's something radically wrong with you. I said, there's something radically right with you. And she looked at me in absolute amazement and I said, does that speak to your soul? And she said, yeah. And I said, OK, so what you do now is go to your spirit, ask permission to go to bed because you're ill. Don't come to the retreat. Nothing that I will say to you on the retreat will speak to your situation. I said, you're absolutely right in knowing that I couldn't speak to your situation. And took a huge leap in faith. And I said, he's coming in a few days and he's coming for his bride. I said, not in death, but in marriage, spiritual marriage. I said, it's private. It's between the two of you. I won't go near you, but I will inquire if everything is OK. We won't leave you on your own. So I said, this is between your superior and you and me and the Lord. I said, nobody else, because we had to keep all curiosity away. She had the most incredible experience about 2 days later. And I asked the superior, how is she doing? And she said, she's sitting up in the bed like a radiant bride, she said. I said, she is a radiant bride. She said, I know. I said, can I go in and just greet her? She said, yeah. And I actually knelt down to greet her. And I said, told you. And I told you you didn't need the retreat. You see, someone at this level of purification, where everything is being challenged, absolutely everything inside of you, you end up questioning your sanity because you haven't come through yet. Do you know what I mean? And it's only when you come through and the light, everything comes into the light, that everything, absolutely everything makes sense. She died a couple of weeks later in extraordinary joy. Absolutely extraordinary joy. It's just that the purification had taken so much out of her that she had got the cancer. The Lord didn't cure the cancer. That wasn't what he wanted. But that was the sign the community needed for them to sort of put their skids on and move on. So I said to the rest of them, would you ever drive your cars a little bit faster? You're all in the slow lane. She's in the fast lane. You know? And then use different images for them. You know, if you're climbing a mountain, wait, for heaven's sake, get a bit of help. You're not going up quick enough. But just seeing her was enough. She died completely radiant. Completely changed. And that's the only image I have in my head reading this. Because otherwise it can come across theoretical. But I've actually seen it in reality. I've seen it happening in a person's life. And it's a beautiful thing. So let's come to the next paragraph and you'll see what happened to her. The heading I have on the paragraph is Transformed into Light. Now, as he was saying this, Louisa said, I found myself outside of myself inside a garden. Now, usually a garden is a representation of the church. And tired, I sat down under a tree to rest. But the rays of the sun darted through me in such a way that I felt I was burning. I wanted to go under some other tree, a thicker one, which would produce more shade so as not to be hurt by the sun. But a voice, and it seems to me that it was my beloved Jesus, prevented me from doing that. You see, our instinctive reaction is to run away from this kind of thing. One who lives in my will, he said, must be exposed to the rays of the burning and eternal sun. That's light. In order to live of or out of, we would say, light, so that they see nothing but light and touch nothing but light. In other words, you're transformed into light. So first of all, I want to give you 1 John 1:5. God is light. So it's transformation in God. What's the second thing I want to say? Yeah, Mount Tabor. Remember, Jesus was transfigured into light. Okay. He was so full of light on the day of the resurrection that they found it difficult to recognize that this was the person they knew. Okay, so you have to live out of light itself. You see nothing but light and touch nothing but light. Now, this leads to the deification of the soul. Isn't that incredible? Now, that's a fundamental teaching of the church, that Jesus became incarnate in order to deify us. Okay. Only when the soul is all deified in God, then can it be said that she lives in my will. So you can see that the rest of us are making attempts, but the living in the divine will is completely radical. A very radical change actually happens to us. And that's why you hear Jesus saying it's a new baptism and all the rest of it. Rather, come out from under this tree and stroll in this celestial Eden of my will. Now, what does that remind you of? God strolling with Adam in the cool of the day, Genesis 3. Okay. So that scanning you thoroughly, oh dear. When you're scanned, they really see what's inside of you, and they expect that the scan won't leave anything there that it doesn't see. So when the Lord scans us thoroughly, then look how much work he realizes he has to do in us. You know, well, maybe he doesn't in you, but he does in me. The sun may convert you into light and may give you the final brushstroke of the deification of God. You become one with God. Is that something else? I began to stroll, Louisa said, and as I was doing this, obedience called me back to myself. So I want to give you Psalm 104, verse 2. It says, Lord, you are robed in majesty. You are wrapped in a robe of light. Okay. So that's telling you where we're going. So I have a VIP on the next one, November the 5th, 1923. And this is Jesus forms his real life, not mystical life, in the soul who lives in his will, as in a living host. His real life. That means that people living in the divine will allow him to return to the earth to continue his ministry on the earth. I was feeling oppressed because of the privation of my sweet Jesus, with the addition that the confessor, because I had not had the trust to open up to him, because I was bad, that means she feels awful, had denied me absolution. Now, I think at her level of relationship with God, to be denied absolution is something else. So, having received Holy Communion, I abandoned myself in the arms of the most sweet Jesus, and I said to him, my love, help me. Do not abandon me. You know in what state I find myself because of your privation. And still, instead of help, creatures add pains upon pains. Without you, I have no one else, either with you or on my own, crying over my hard lot of having lost you. This should push you more not to leave me alone. That's quietly giving out to him. To at least keep company with the poor abandoned one who lives dying in her hard exile. And therefore, since you are the highest priest, give me absolution. I love that. The confessor refused her absolution and she goes over his head and goes to a higher priest. I think that's brilliant. You can tell me that you forgive the sins that are in my soul. Let me hear your most sweet voice that gives me life and forgiveness. Now, Jesus' response to this is only divine. And the heading I have for myself is the Sacred Host. Now, while I was pouring out my pain with Jesus, he himself made himself seen in my interior. That's your Luke 17, 21. The kingdom of God is within you. And Jesus was inside of it, alive and real. Now, you might ask, what does mystical mean? And it means that you are living a highly graced life very sensitive to the presence of the Lord, but you're not necessarily having visions and revelations and all the rest of it. Someone said recently that mystical means behind the veil, that all of this wonderful stuff is going on, but there is a veil for you and for everybody else. In the divine will, he comes to actually live in your soul, no mystical veil. Is that okay? Your body is actually the accidents that hold this divine presence, just like the bread in the sacred host is the accidents that hold the divine presence. It's just amazing. My sweet Jesus told me, my daughter, this mirror is the accidents of the bread which keep me imprisoned within them. I form my life in the host, but the host does not give me anything, not one affection, heartbeat, and not the littlest I love you. It is as though dead for me. I remain alone without a shadow of requital. That's response. And therefore, my love is almost impatient to go out to shatter this glass, descending into hearts in order to find in them that response which the host does not know how to give me, nor can it do so because it's only bread. But do you know where I can find my true response or requital? In the soul who lives in my will. As I descend into her heart, immediately I consume the accidents of the host. Have you noticed?
I consume, he says.
In other words, he doesn't wait 15 minutes for the body to consume it. That was the bit I wanted you to notice, yeah? Because I know that more noble accidents, more dear to me, are ready to imprison me so as not to let me go out of that heart, which will give me not only within which will give me not only life within itself, but life for life. I will not be alone, but with my most faithful company. Now, one of the things that's very, very frequent in these writings is that Jesus says he doesn't want to be alone on the earth. Most of the rest of us don't either. Okay, but he doesn't want to be alone. And hence the leaving him alone in the tabernacle is not wonderful. Okay. We will be two hearts palpitating together. This is a wonderful thing about adoration. We will love united together and our desires will be one. So I remain in her and there I live life alive and real, just as I do in the Most Holy Sacrament. Now, we've all long since accepted the real presence in the Blessed Sacrament. It's quite another matter to say the real presence is in me and the real presence is in you. That's the bit we've got to take on board. And that's the reality of living in the divine will. Okay. But do you know what these accidents are which I find in the soul that does mine? Somebody has a mobile phone on. Have you a mobile phone on? But do you know what these accidents are which I find in the soul who does my will? They are her acts. Really circle that now. They are her acts done in my volition, which more than accidents lay themselves around me and imprison me, but inside a noble and divine prison, not a dark one, because the acts done in my will more than sun illuminate her and warm her. Okay. Oh, how happy I feel to form my real life in her, because those acts are all divine, aren't they? And they create divine lives, don't they? Because I feel as if I were inside my celestial royal palace. Look at me inside your heart, he said, how happy I am, how I delight and feel the purest joys. And Louisa said, my beloved Jesus, isn't what you're telling me somehow new and singular? The answer is yes. That in one who lives in your will, you form your real life. Isn't it rather the mystical life which you form in the hearts which possess your grace? And Jesus said, no, no, it's not my mystical life, as for those who possess my grace and who do not live with their acts identified within my volition. Look at that. How important that is, their acts not identified. They do not have sufficient material to form the accidents in order to imprison me. It would be as if the priest did not have the host and wanted to pronounce the words of consecration. So that there's nowhere for the presence to actually lodge. Okay? He could say them, but he would say them to empty space. My sacramental life would certainly not have existence. And this is how I am in the hearts which, though they may possess my grace, do not live completely in my will. Now, the word you ring there is completely. Completely. And your Deuteronomy 6, 4 to 10, which I've given you endlessly, talks about the completely. You must love the Lord with all your heart, all your soul, all your mind and all your being. Deuteronomy 6, 4 to 10. They do not live completely in my will. That means they're only living partially in the divine will. I am in them by grace, but not in reality. Isn't that incredible? And Louisa said, my love, but how can it be that you live life really in the soul who lives in your will? And Jesus said, my daughter, do I perhaps not live in the sacramental host, alive and real, body, blood, soul and divinity? Now, there you have the doctrine of the church absolutely underlined for you. And why do I live in the host in body, blood, soul and divinity? Because there is not a will that opposes me. Now, notice the operative thing there. And he wants to do the same thing in any person whose will does not oppose him. That's logical, isn't it? If I found in the host a will opposite to mine, I would form neither real nor perennial life in it. This is also the reason why the sacramental accidents are consumed when creatures receive me, because I do not find a human will united with me in such a way as to want to lose its will in order to acquire mine. That's to substitute one for the other. But I find a will that wants to act, that wants to do things on its own. In other words, I decide to do them. And for my reasons. So that's the human will dominating there. So I make my little visit and I leave. That's very sad. On the other hand, for one who lives in my will, my volition and hers are one. And if I do this in the host, how much more can I do it in her? More so, since I find a heartbeat, an affection, my return and my interest, which I do not find in the host. To the soul who lives in my will, my real life within her is necessary. Otherwise, how could she live in my volition? You see, the will is the highest faculty that we have, isn't it? The thing that operates your entire life. Well, the will is the highest faculty in the divinity, the operating part of the Blessed Trinity. And Jesus says, if my will is going to be in you, I have to be there. Because that's the central part of me. So we can't have two centres of power, one fighting the other, the human will and the divine will. One has to give way to the other. And so that's why it's his real life. It's not just grace. Now, in dealing with the spirituality, before you come to the divine will spirituality, it's all grace. And if you go deep into it, it's mystical union. OK, when you come into the divine will spirituality, it's not that. It is similar to the sacramental host. that he is actually living in us and we become the accidents that hold this divine presence. Is that okay? So, so to the soul who lives in my will, my real life within her is necessary. Otherwise, how could she live in my volition? You don't want to understand that the sanctity of living in my will is a sanctity completely different from all other sanctities. Now, this has to be repeated over and over because the priests who are guiding Louisa are only learning this as Louisa learns it. They don't have this information before her. And so they can't say to her, this is how you respond to this kind of message. They're hearing it for the first time. So in a lot of the dialogue that we're reading, I hear the dialogues that's going on between the priests and saying to Louisa, you know, you'd need to really ask clarification on this and so on. So there's something that's terribly important for us to tell people that we teach, that this sanctity is very different to all other sanctities. And this sanctity takes off where the other sanctity, this sanctity begins where the other sanctities end. Except for the crosses, the mortifications and the necessary acts of life which done in my will embellish the soul more, it's nothing other than the life of the blessed in heaven. Now, he has told us that numerous times, that to live in the divine will on earth is to live the life that the blessed are living in heaven, except that we're still on the earth and we still have suffering and so on. Who, because they live in my will and by virtue of the divine will, have me within each one of them as if I were there with them alone, alive and real, and not mystically, but really dwelling within them. Okay, now he's emphasized that enough, hasn't he? And just as this could not be called the life of heaven if it did not have me within them as their own life, and their happiness would be neither complete nor perfect if even a tiny particle of my life were missing in them. Have you noticed that bit? It wouldn't be complete if even a tiny part of his life is missing. Therefore, the suffering and the passion cannot be missing. A Christian without a cross is an anachronism. So even it couldn't be complete or perfect if a tiny particle of my life were missing in them. In the same way, for one who lives in my will could be neither full nor perfect in her. Perfect is complete, needing nothing else. Because my real life, which emits this will, would be missing. So he is where his will is. I can put it that way. And his will is where he is. It's true that these are all prodigies of my love, even more the prodigy of prodigies which my will has kept within itself until now, and which it now wants to issue in order to achieve the primary purpose of the creation of man. Therefore, my first real life I want to form in you. Because she's the first. On hearing this, Louisa said, Ah, my love, Jesus, yet I feel so bad because of all these contrasts, and you know it. It's true, you know it is Psalm 139. You know my thoughts before I think them and my words before I say them. It's true that this serves me to abandon myself more in your arms and to ask from you what they do not give me. But in spite of this, I feel a breath of disturbance. Now, you were told in volume one, no disturbance of any kind is tolerated. Why is that? Because if there is disturbance in the depths of your soul, that gives the enemy a tiny little entry point. But I feel a breath of disturbance that troubles the peace of my soul. And you are saying that you want to form your real life in me. And he has just said, even if a tiny bit is out, it's not going to work. Oh, how far I am from this, she said. And Jesus said, daughter, do not worry about this. What I want is that you put nothing of your own into it. That's nothing of the human, the earthly, and so on. And that you obey as much as you can. Now, absolutely love that statement, because sometimes you can only obey as much as you can in a little way, and in other times it can be in a big way. It depends on the pressures that are on you outside and inside as to how much response you can give. So as much as you can. It is known that all other sanctities, that is, those of obedience and of other virtues, are not exempt, watch this, from pettiness, disturbance, conflicts, waste of time, which prevent the forming of a beautiful son. Now, here Jesus is admitting that people we've canonized had real faults. I don't know if that consoles you. Mm-hmm. But one of the things I used to hate when I was younger, reading Lives of the Saints, and they were written as if the person was just pluperfect. And if you do that, I just throw the book there and say, that's nothing to do with me. Give me somebody who had a real problem and worked their way out, and that'll help. You know, St. Bernadette of Lourdes is supposed to have said, one time in answer to a question, when she was ill, she was reading a life of a saint, and one of the sisters in her community asked her, you know, what have you learned from this? She said, nothing. She said, you've learned nothing from a saint? She said, no. She said, if the author had written the sins of the saints, the rest of us could learn to know what to do with them. She says, if you write the thing absolutely perfect, there's nothing to learn. Whereas if you see somebody struggling from one position to another, and you can see how it actually works out and how grace comes in at a particular point, then you have a key to dealing with something in your own life, you know. And there's only very great people like Jeremiah and St. Paul who could tell you their faults. I love in Paul's confession in 1 Corinthians 7, the things I want to do, I don't do, and the things I don't want to do, I find myself doing. I said, thanks be to God, he was human, you know, because then that gives you an understanding of yourself, which is actually terribly important. So these sanctities were not exempt from pettiness. That's interesting. Disturbance, conflicts, and waste of time. Right, that's brilliant. I don't know about you, which prevent the forming of a beautiful son. At the most, they form a little star. Only the sanctity of my will is exempt from these miseries. And besides, my will encloses all the sacraments and their effects. Now note this. Therefore, abandon yourself completely in my will, make it your own, and you will receive the effects of the absolution or of anything else that you might have been denied. I got that message, did you? Are you absolutely sure you got it? Let me read it again. Besides, my will encloses all of the sacraments and their effects. Therefore, abandon yourself completely in my will and make it your own, and you will receive the effects of the absolution which she had asked for. Do you remember? Mm-hmm. Or of anything else that you might have been denied. So supposing a terrible storm comes and none of us can get to Mass and you can't do this, that and the other, you can clock into the whole thing in the divine will. It doesn't mean that you don't go to Mass in normal times, but there are times when, he says, when something is denied you, that you can, in the divine will, you can access it. I think that's fantastic. So I recommend to you, don't waste time, because by wasting time, you come to hamper my real life, which I am forming in you. That's a wonderful piece, isn't it? So November the 8th, 1923. When Jesus came on earth, he observed, perfected and abolished the ancient laws in order to establish the new law of grace. Now that is a most perfect summary of the Old Testament. It's the most perfect summary of the Old Testament. When did Jesus finally abolish the law? Wasn't it on the cross? Yeah. And what was the sign that the veil of the temple split in two, indicating that the covenant of Moses was finished? In the same way, watch this now, because this is terribly important, because you've been told that to be told something else. Okay, So in the same way, Louisa suffers in the divine will all the interior states present on the path of human sanctities. He gives completion to them and gives rise to the sanctity of the divine will. Now, since Louisa is the one to be the first to live the divine will, we're not talking about our Blessed Lady and Jesus, and to start the kingdom of the divine will, everything in terms of sanctity that has been done before then has got to be relived, redone, completed, finished, and open up to the new thing. That's the logic. Weren't expecting that, were you? Take real note of that, okay? And I would put a VIP on that one, because that is not something you hear people talking about. Probably because they'd be afraid of the kickback, you know. They would have killed Jesus sooner if he had told them that he was completing the law of Moses. So Louisa said, his privations continue. At the most, he comes like fleeting flash. And while it seems that it may want to make light, one remains in the dark more than before. Now, while I was swimming in the bitterness of his privation, my sweet Jesus made himself seen in my interior. That's your Luke 17:21. All busy writing. Now, writing is not something you really associate with him, do you? Not with a pen, but with his finger, which emitted rays of light. And that light served him as a pen in order to write in the depths of my soul. Now, beside that, I want you to put Jeremiah 31:33. Jeremiah 31:33. He will write it on your heart. Okay, which is exactly what he's doing. Heart for the Bible means your person. I wanted to tell him who knows how many things about my poor soul. But putting his finger on his lips, he made me understand that I should keep silent, for he didn't want to be distracted. And then after he finished, he told me, daughter of my supreme volition, I am writing in your soul the law of my will. I will write it on your hearts. That's what the Lord said to Jeremiah. The new covenant will be written on our hearts so that everybody would know interiorly. Okay. First, I want to write it in your soul, and then little by little, I will explain it to you. This is where you can ask for the gift of the divine will, and later on, you come to understand it bit by bit by bit. And Louisa said, my Jesus, I want to tell you of the state of my soul. Oh, how bad I feel. Tell me, why do you leave me? Now, he's trying to tell her something absolutely extraordinarily important. And she's back to me. Isn't it amazing? This is us. And Jesus said, do not afflict yourself, my daughter. You must know that when I came upon the earth, I came to abolish the ancient laws. Look at that. Now, that's as clear as daylight. And I came to perfect others. Okay. But in abolishing them, I did not exempt myself from observing those laws. He observed the law of Moses perfectly. And the Gospels go out of their way to say, you know, that such and such an obligation, he actually fulfills it. Do you remember the case where somebody asked Peter, does your master pay the half shekel? And he paid the half shekel. But Jesus said, you know, there's actually no obligation on us to do it. We belong to a different kingdom, a different sphere. But we mustn't scandalize them, so we pay the half shekel. Rather, he said, I observe them in a more perfect way. It's a more complete way than others did. But having to unite the old and the new within myself, I wanted to observe them in order to give completion to the ancient laws. In other words, the law of Moses came from God, and Jesus was the only one who fulfilled the law perfectly because he was divine as well as human. So all of God's obligations in the Mosaic law were fulfilled by Jesus. So placing on them the seal of their abolition and to give rise to the new law. Now, there's a huge answer here to many Christians who have who through charismatic prayer groups have come under the influence of evangelical Christians. And they come to be told, yes, you do have to obey the laws of Moses. There's absolutely no way you can eat pig meat, for example. That's totally, absolutely, according to the law of Moses. You Catholics don't keep the Shabbat on the right day. It's on the Saturday. It's not on a Sunday. And what they're doing is they're going back into the Mosaic law, which has been abolished. It's finished. And you don't go back to something that's dead and gone. You have to leave it there. It's terribly important what he's saying here. I placed on them the seal of their abolition and to give rise to a new law. So he's talking here about the old law versus the new. Now, of course, the teaching for us is the old sanctity versus the new. Mm-hmm. And of course, you automatically go back to what you know. And we slip back into that without even knowing we do it. So I came to give rise to the new law, which I came to establish on the earth, a law of grace and love, by which I enclosed all sacrifices within myself. You see, he completes the whole sacrificial system. Since I was to be the true and only sacrificed one. Therefore, all other sacrifices were no longer necessary, and the evangelicals are correct on that one. But they misunderstand the Mass completely. Because I, being man and God, this was more than sufficient to satisfy for all. Now, you will get that summary that's been given to you there, you will find in the letter to the Hebrews, chapter 12. The letter to the Hebrews, chapter 12, verses 18 to 29. Same teaching. Okay. Now, he's not telling that to us to tell us about the old law and the new law, because that was established 2,000 years ago. He's telling us that to help us to go over from the old sanctities to the new sanctity. Okay? So this is what you're going to get in the next paragraph, the old sanctities versus the new one. Now, beloved daughter of mine, wanting to make of you a more perfect image of myself and to give rise to a new sanctity. Now, where the images of God is Romans 8:29. And to give rise to a new sanctity, so noble and divine. Now, what's different is the divine, which is the fiat voluntas tua sequit in cielo et in terra. I want to centralize in you all the interior states which have been until now on the path of sanctity. This is why Louisa goes through so many agonies and she doesn't know whether it's winter or summer, or whether she's growing or whether she's going backwards. And he is trying to give her something absolutely extraordinary. And she says, but I'm so bad. Do you know what I mean? And it's this thing that she has to actually experience all the spiritualities leading up to then. So she has to go through penance and fervor and all of John of the Cross stuff and Teresa of Avila stuff and everything. It's horrendous. Absolutely horrendous. But it explains the extraordinary variety that she actually experiences. So you have to experience all the interior states which have been until now. And as you suffer them and move on. Now, the bit that's difficult for us is moving on. Okay. So I have to put an NB for myself and for others who lived on the spirituality of John of the Cross all our lives. And that is, you have to move on from John of the Cross and Teresa of Avila and on to the spirituality of the divine will. That's not easy if your whole life, as mine was based on this Carmelite spirituality. And you have to suffer them and you have to move on. Doing this in my will, and I give completion to them. That means they're finished. Now, we have a problem, haven't we? Am I the only one thinking of the problem, or have you thought of it as well? That means you can't go back to the old sanctities to learn from them. They're finished. I give completion to them. And they can only tell you where they're at. And I've said to people, look, I know this sounds terrible, but John of the Cross and Teresa of Avila were the 16th century, we're the 21st. And the church has actually grown. You mightn't think it, but it has actually grown in that length of time. And has grown in understanding of all kinds of things. And people find it. Carmelites would have me strung from the first tree for saying that. I crown them and embellishing them, I give them the seal. That's the seal of completion. You only seal a scroll when it's finished. You roll it up, seal it and put it away. Okay? Everything must end in my will. Because all of these people who had all of these sanctities had to end up in the divine will in heaven. But they didn't have the divine will until they got to heaven. Is that okay? Mm-hmm. And there where other sanctities end, the sanctity of my will being noble and divine has all other sanctities as its footstool. And that's where you have its beginning. And that's where a lot of us, including myself, have really struggled. How you go from the older sanctities to the new one. Because the problem is you don't know enough about the new one to shift from where you are. Okay. Therefore, let me do that. Give me the freedom to work. Let me repeat my life and that which I did in redemption with so much love. Now with greater love, I want to repeat it in you to set the beginning that my will and its laws may be known. But I want your will united to and dissolved in mine. Now, that actually requires a good bit of thinking and going over. Unless you're an awful lot better than me. I'm going to leave it there for tonight.